Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and again, we hope you're having a happy Christmas. We're listening back to a series of interviews on memoirs from the past year. Today, many families are together for the holiday, but many are not, because loved ones may be overseas in the military or working as foreign correspondents. That's the subject of our next interview. In the past half century, the work of foreign correspondents has changed dramatically. Once upon a time, they traveled first class and filed from the front lines via telegram. Now, independent freelancers don helmets and flak jackets, carry GoPros and iPhones, and head into war zones without the protection of established news organizations. Few people understand that change as well as legendary correspondent H.D.S. Greenway. He reported from more than 90 war zones around the world for Time magazine, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. This past summer, my co-host Meghna Chakrabarty spoke to David Greenway about his memoir, Foreign Correspondent. She began by asking Greenway about the assignment that defined his career and perspective, Vietnam.
Well, Saigon was very much a French city then. As you know, the Americans decided to back up the French, and the French had fought a long war trying to keep Vietnam and lost. And then when they lost, we stepped into their shoes and tried to keep South Vietnam a pro-American sphere. And we lost that one too. But Saigon in the 60s was still very much a French city. And I had deplorable French, and a lot of Vietnamese looked down on me because my French was so bad.
And you write about how, I believe in the early days, you were staying in the Continental Hotel in Saigon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was a great old pile built somewhere around the turn of the 19th and 20th century. It is where Graham Greene had written about, and so it had a lot of history.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I'm asking, because in your memoir, Foreign Correspondent, and of course in your reporting for that time, it's just really replete with this sense of how even you, from your first days in Vietnam, it's clear that here's a country that's trying to basically wrest itself away from the colonialism that it was under for so many years. But that process is so violent and so long and so painful.
The Cold War so dominated American thinking that they didn't see that a much more important trend was happening in the shadow of the Cold War, and that was the anti-colonial struggle after World War II. And I think that we saw Vietnam through the communist, anti-communist Cold War lens. Their way of looking at it was the anti-colonial lens, and I think that's why the communists were more successful than we were, because they could claim nationalism was on their side and they were trying to free the country from foreign rule.
Hmm. Well, can you talk to us about the challenges of being a foreign correspondent in Vietnam in the mid to late 60s? I mean, you talk about in the book how you made very close friends and one of your closest Vietnamese friends in your time there. Later on, you discover that he was actually a spy for Hanoi the entire time.
Yes, one of the Vietnamese reporters for Time magazine, Phan Xuan An, turned out that he'd been a spy for the North Vietnamese all along. He'd started as a spy against the French. So it was quite dramatic to find out that he had been a spy. So when I went back to Vietnam after the war, I looked him up. I asked him what his job had been. Did he want to deceive us? Did he want to twist our copy around so we wouldn't be reporting the truth? He said, no. My masters didn't want me to touch the Time magazine's coverage. What they were interested in was my evaluation of South Vietnamese units, which commanders might be on our side secretly, which could be bribed to be on our side, on which we're absolutely unbribable and we should stay away from. Hmm. So that, he said, was his main job.
Hmm. You know, there's so much we could talk about just about Vietnam. I do want to move on to some of your experiences in other countries. But before I do, there is something that you wrote that I'd love to hear more about. You say that reporters fell in love with Vietnam or Indochina more broadly in a way that you didn't see in other places or later wars. Why do you think that is?
I think that Southeast Asia is very seductive. It has the Buddhist religion is very attractive, and its scenery is magic. And I just think it has more appeal than I think reporters there found it had more appeal. And I never found the same feelings in El Salvador or Afghanistan or the Middle East that people had about Southeast Asia.
Hmm. Well, there's a section of your book, a little excerpt of your time in Cambodia, where you went in the mid-70s, I believe. Of course, the conflict had spread to Cambodia and bombing was going on there. And I was wondering if you could just read this particular excerpt for us. It has to do with what happened at a school close to near where you were.
Sure. Later in the war, when the Khmer Rouge rockets were arriving in Phnom Penh, I pulled my mosquito-netted bed away from the window in case a round should burst in the trees outside, sending shrapnel into my room. One hot afternoon, when I was sitting writing a long article for the Sunday paper, I heard an incoming rocket burst not far from the hotel. There was a moment of silence, and then the high-pitched, desperate cries of children screaming, bird-like screaming, in a way I'd never heard before or since. The rocket had landed on a school, and the sight, when I went to see, of blood-soaked sandals lying in the dust with small bodies torn to pieces was heartbreaking. But it's the sound of those screams that I can sometimes hear still in my worst dreams almost 40 years later.
Mr. Greenway, when I read that section amongst many sections in your book, I had to wonder, how is it after so many years, so many wars, seeing so many, basically the nadir of humanity, that it never seems as if you became a cynic about humanity and the places and the countries and the people that you were covering?
Well, my old boss at the Boston Globe, Tom Winship, always used to say, never lose your optimism. Not a bad thing to try to live by.
Well, I mean, it's a wise phrase, but hard to put into practice. I mean, was your optimism challenged on any of your assignments?
I wasn't optimistic about how things were going to turn out in Indochina. I might not have been cynical about it, but I was very pessimistic. And I'm afraid my experiences in Indochina made me quite pessimistic in Iraq, as I now see I had good reason to be, and in Afghanistan, which the jury is still out how that will turn out.
Mm. Forgive me for pressing you on this, but this is one thing which we as consumers of the reporting that comes from foreign correspondents, the one thing that we can never have is the immediacy of the human impact of these wars and conflicts. And so, I mean, that's why I'm asking if, you know, as a human being yourself, were there ever times where you said, I have to step back from this? There are too many blood-soaked sandals lying in the dust everywhere I go.
Well, I think the nature of journalism is that from time to time you do step back and you write that summing up story of how you see the situation going, you know, what your sources are telling you. So there are many step back moments. But I might add that wars are dangerous, and Edward R. Murrow, his connection with CBS wasn't going to save him if a German bomb hit him.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, another one of the many interesting places that you reported from that I enjoy reading in the book, in the memoir, was actually Bangladesh. Because first of all, I mean, in the story of the emergence of Bangladesh and India's war with Pakistan over all of this, there's a humanitarian crisis that you covered, the movement of, 7 million refugees at the time. Plus, there's a story in which you talk about how the hotel that you were in was bombed.
Well, I was up in my room writing a story, and I decided in those days I smoked. So I went down to the lobby to buy some smokes, and the wall disintegrated and knocked me down, and I had a concussion. But the worst damage, I was lucky to be so close to the wall because it knocked me down, and then the bricks went out in the lobby and hurt more people in the lobby than they hurt me.
Hmm. The Bangladesh story is interesting to me because, as you write in the book, one of the great themes that connects the episodes of your reporting life is, as you say, the process of decolonization. That's so much.
There was Bangladesh trying, who was part of Pakistan, but felt it was a colony of Pakistan, was trying to break away from Pakistan to be its own country.
Exactly, which of course Pakistan was born out of the British leaving the Indian subcontinent in 1947. I mean, you write that Time magazine basically put it that it was a geographical curiosity, a political absurdity. This is a theme that comes up again and again in the Middle East, in Africa, in all these places where it seems as if, you know, as you write, the U.S., in this case, now we're talking about America, blunders in and blunders out, in your words, repeating the same mistakes of would-be empires before it.
Well, I'm afraid that's true. I had an interview with the Russian ambassador in Afghanistan, and he basically said, you're making the same mistakes we did. We thought that everyone in Afghanistan would want to be like us if they had a chance, and you're making the same mistake.
Hmm. Well, tell us a little bit more about your time in Afghanistan. There's a story that you write in the book when you're in Kabul and an Afghan man comes up to you on the street of chickens.
Yes, that was a street with, I don't know why it was called, they must have sold chickens there in the past. But when I was there, they had little trinket shops and antique shops. And I went in to buy a present for my wife. And this fellow, it was getting cold and towards the end of October, and this fellow swathed in his robes, you couldn't see his face, came up and took my hand and asked me if I was a Christian. And I had known that on that same street, a woman covered, her face covered, had come up to a Western woman and taken her hand and then set off a bomb and killed everybody and wounded people in the street. So naturally I was a little nervous about this guy asking about my religion. So I answer that I'm a person of the book because Muslims believe that Christians and Jews believe one God in one God like they do. So they're people of the book, better than heathens. But all he wanted to tell me was that when the Russians had come and were occupying Kabul, they didn't feel afraid to walk around the city. But all our diplomats were rushing around in armored cars and too afraid to come out and meet the people. And he put that, he said there were many Russians, many Muslims in the Russian army, and you don't have enough Muslims in your army. And that's why you're so afraid all the time.
So when he talked to you about Russia's history in Afghanistan, that had meaning for you because you had already been reporting for so very long from places where these footprints of empire were still readily apparent. I'm wondering, as you look upon the task of a foreign correspondent today, I mean, we were talking earlier how so many of them are freelancers. Not many people get to stay in the same place for a long time. I mean, you were in Vietnam for 8 years in the 60s. Do you think that we're getting the same sort of depth of correspondence that we once could 50 years ago?
I wouldn't say that today's reporters are any less skillful, but it's just that there are fewer outlets for their work, and the newspapers aren't are starting to cut down on their coverage. I mean, I started several bureaus for the Boston Globe in the days when the Boston Globe had a lot of money. But now they're all closed, and the Boston Globe has no foreign bureaus at all. Mm-hmm. And there's no substitute for living in the country, because that means that every moment of your downtime, you're living and experiencing the culture of that place.
Yeah. As you say that, I'm an image of you, as you write in your memoir, in Indochina, in a sarong, writing by candlelight on your typewriter is floating through my mind.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So what do you think one of your great lessons is after 50 years of having done this, having been witness to history in so many parts of the world?
Well, I noticed in all the places I've been that you could have briefings in the capital by optimistic people that bore very little resemblance, if any at all, to what was really going on in the field. And the great Sebastian Junger, I quote him in the book as saying in Afghanistan, it's not that the officials were lying, it's just that they were inviting you to join a conspiracy of wishful thinking. And I think probably the great fault in American occupation in countries has been too much wishful thinking.
Mr. Greenway, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
That's HDS Greenway, who reported from around the world for almost a half a century, talking to my co-host Meghna Chakrabarty. His memoir is called Foreign Correspondent. Stay with us. Coming up, what makes things funny? We'll ask one of Britain's great talents, comedic legend and founding member of Monty Python, John Cleese. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.